Hello, and welcome to the Pursuing Veritas podcast, a podcast dedicated to reflecting on theology, history, and culture from the perspective of a follower of Jesus. Welcome to episode 7 of the Pursuing Veritas podcast. So thankful you're able to join us today as we talk about if Christians should engage philosophy or not. This is a question that the church has wrestled with for some time, and today we're going to talk about two particularly important figures who discussed the relationship between theology and philosophy in early Christianity, those two figures being Tertullian of Carthage and Justin Martyr. I hope you enjoy our conversation and that it is helpful for you as you wrestle with your own faith.
Last week we talked about how we encounter God. We talked about Gnosticism and Christian responses to Gnosticism. Today, we're looking at what was effectively an intra-Christian debate. So last week was kind of looking outside of mainstream Christianity. Today, we're looking kind of inside mainstream Christianity. At about the same time as Irenaeus, 2nd and 3rd centuries, Christians were really wrestling with this question of, should we engage philosophy? Should Christians engage philosophy? So when you hear the word philosophy, what do you think about it? Like, what comes to mind? Plato, good answer. Not the clay-like substance that kids play with. That's good too. We'll talk about Plato, I promise. Ancient Greek philosopher.
Plato.
Yeah. P-L-A-T-O. Plato.
Now I
The love of wisdom.
The love of wisdom. All right, very good. That's what philosophy means. Says the philosopher. That's right. Good. Ladies, guess when you hear philosophy, do you think of anything?
Traditions.
All right. Good traditions, bad traditions, or just any tradition. All right. So, the philosophy we're talking about today is ancient philosophy, and it is what Kyle said, the love of wisdom, philosophia.
Actually, just spell it for you.
Love of wisdom. And that's different than modern philosophy. Most of the time. So like I work in a building where we have the philosophy department, and the things that they are doing, modern analytical philosophy, is very oftentimes quite different than what the ancient world meant when they meant philosophy. Philosophy in the ancient world was very much a way of thinking, a way of life, the principles and the values that you hold most dear and that you use to make decisions. And sometimes modern philosophy is like that too, but very oftentimes it's preoccupied with other sorts of things and proving other issues. So, up front, I think we want to be clear. We're talking about something that's different most of the time than if you walk into a modern philosophy department or talk about philosophy or try to talk about philosophy with a modern philosopher. So, speaking of experience. So, we're going to start today with some context. All right? The philosophical tradition is rich and deep, and by the time you get to the 2nd and 3rd centuries, there are some people you need to have heard of, there are some ideas that are going to be circulating in the Greco-Roman world, and so just very briefly, and I'm sorry Kyle, for I'm probably not doing this justice, a brief history of philosophy in the ancient world. So the first people we need to start with are the pre-Socratics. These are really the first people whose work has come down to us, who really begin wrestling with the nature of things. Where do things come from? Can we describe things? Can we describe things mathematically? Right? These are the sorts of questions that the pre-Socratics would wrestle with. And then, of course, they're called pre-Socratics because the first important philosopher is, first really important philosopher, no, is Socrates. Ancient Greece, 4th century BCE, and Socrates really orders subsequent philosophy, and he says, he talks about, what is the good life? How do you know what the good life is? How do you talk to other people about what the good life is? So Socrates really, at least in the Western philosophical tradition, really gets the ball rolling. And Socrates has a student. Socrates' student is, most famous student, is Plato. Again, Plato. And Plato is, ostensibly, the greatest philosopher ever. It's often said that all subsequent philosophy, at least Western philosophy, is but a footnote to Plato. That is, Plato sets the stage for what philosophy is like. Plato is, in a sense, like Jesus. If you're doing Christian theology, you have to take seriously Jesus, and you have to start from Jesus, and that's how it is with Plato. If you're going to do modern philosophy, you have to start with what Plato says and the arguments that Plato makes, because that's where everybody else starts. So Plato wrestles with all sorts of questions. He wrestles with this thing called epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. So how do we know? And he also touches on this thing called metaphysics. What is real? What is the cosmos made of? And for Plato, there's this really important idea. It's called the realm of the forms. And that is, this is a table. And you know this is a table because it corresponds to this thing in the realm of the forms that you know and recognize as a table. This is a table because it participates in tableness. That's the quick and easy way to say that, right? So there is a non-physical realm where real things exist. And in our physical realm, things are real because of their association with the truly real thing in the realm of the forms. This is a hugely important idea in the history of philosophy. We'll touch on this in a little bit later, but just know there's this thing called the realm of the forms, really important for Platonism. Plato also has a student, and his student's name is Aristotle. Aristotle has a student. His name is Alexander the Great, but we're not talking about that today. Aristotle really develops physics and causality. He wants to tell us about how things work and then why things happen. So Aristotle will give us four forms of causality: material, formal, efficient, final. This is going to become a gigantic debate in the medieval church. What caused this? Aristotle has arguments for the existence of God that become very important. This idea that there has to be a first cause that gets everything rolling. Aristotle, again, hugely, hugely influential. And then Aristotle also has metaphysics that's really important when it comes to discussing communion. So when we talk about communion next spring, when we talk about communion during the time of the Reformation, Roman Catholicism will appeal to Aristotle a lot, because the difference he draws between the essence of something and the substance of something, the thing that is really in this is a podium because it is essentially a podium, and the substance is also a podium. Okay. This could be essentially a person, but substantively a podium as well, hypothetically. Things can be other than what they appear. You have to figure out what the essence is, and you have to figure out what the substance is, what they look like. So I know I'm losing all of you because this is philosophy. But Aristotle, very important, especially when it comes to metaphysics. All right, so Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle and the pre-Socratics, are really 5th through 3rd century BCE, okay? So they're 300 years before Jesus. Just think about it that way. 300 years before Jesus. There are other philosophers and there are other developments between Aristotle and the time of Jesus. But what we really want to be interested in is what has happened to Plato and Aristotle by the time of Jesus. And various philosophical schools have developed. And a couple are especially important if you're reading the New Testament and you're wrestling with early Christianity. These are the Epicureans. The Epicureans think that pleasure is the greatest good. So you do what feels good. There are the Cynics. And if you're a Cynic, you want to be free from desire. get rid of all your possessions, you kind of wander around, and you try to rid yourself of desire. There are middle Platonists. They would have just called themselves Platonists, but they're not Platonists like Plato is, and they're not Platonists like later Christians are Platonists. They're middle Platonists. And middle Platonists think that matter is a receptacle of evil. Bad things, wickedness, exists in material things. So, Gnosticism, very, very reliant on middle Platonism, the idea that flesh is inherently wicked, that this physical world that we have around us is somehow necessarily evil, because that's where evil resides. That's a very middle Platonic idea. And then the fourth really important kind of first century school is Stoicism. And that for the Stoics, you're supposed to live according to your nature. So there are innate ways that you're supposed to live and you're supposed to think. You're endowed by the Creator with certain things you're supposed to do. And in order to be the best person you can be, you live out those desires. You live out your nature. Stoicism. So, Epicureanism, Cynicism, Middle Platonism, Stoicism. These are the kind of the four really big philosophical schools around the first century. And you will see references to these schools and or their thoughts in the New Testament. Paul will argue with Epicureans. Jesus will sometimes interact with Cynicism. John goes after Middle Platonism in a couple of places. Paul actually inhabits some certain forms of Stoic thought, kind of changes some Stoic terminology, especially in his letter to the Romans and in Galatians. This is what's in the air. This is what's in the air in the first century. What is also in the air is this Jewish guy whose name is Philo of Alexandria. Philo lives 25 BCE to 50 CE, so he's alive the entire time Jesus is alive, and a little bit after, and a little bit before. And what Philo does is he really tries to take the Jewish worldview and mesh it with Platonic thought. And so for Philo, for example, there's this realm of the forms that Plato talks about, but then there's also the words and thoughts of Yahweh. And Philo is the first person to argue that those are actually the same thing. So the realm of the forms that Plato talks about is actually just a Greek way of talking about the mind of God. Because all things true, if God is perfect, all perfect things truly exist in the mind of God, and we know that the realm of the form is all perfect things. So there it is, right there. That's Philo's argument in a nutshell. So Philo is also very important for early Christianity, especially for the Gospel of John, because he really is beginning to identify a certain form of Platonism with Yahweh, and that's important. So, okay, Jake, you bored us with philosophy for 10 minutes here. Now what? This is the context we need to be aware of as we enter the second and third centuries of Christianity, because these are still the ideas that people are talking about. If you went into Athens or you went into Rome and you sat down with the movers and shakers of the intellectual world, they're arguing about this stuff. When Paul goes to Athens, he goes to the Areopagus. This is what they're arguing about all the time. And so as Christians in the second and third century continue to live in a world where these ideas are talked about and debated, they are trying to figure out what's useful. Can we be cynics who are Christians? Can we take Stoic ideas, and do Stoic ideas fit with Christianity? What would it mean to be a Christian who believes that Plato is right, but also that Jesus has come into the world? These are the questions that Christians are wrestling with. And so as Christians think about, should I engage philosophy, there are two Christians in particular who take pretty diametrically opposed positions. And so we want to look at them today. And their names are Tertullian of Carthage and Justin Martyr, who is not given that name at birth. Did not go around his whole life going, oh my gosh, I'm going to be martyred someday. So So Tertullian lives the year 160, about 160 to 220. So for about 60 years. He's trained as a lawyer in Carthage, which is North Africa. And he converts to Christianity a little before the year 200. So he's 30, 40, something like that. He converts to Christianity. Tertullian is the first Christian to write the word Trinity, Trinitatis, in Latin. And he's also the first Latin Christian theologian. That is, everybody up until Tertullian writes in Greek, if they're a Christian, or at least what we have is extant in Greek. It survives in Greek. But Tertullian writes in Latin. And so all of the later Latin theologians, some of whom we'll talk about over the next several weeks, Cyprian and Augustine among them, they are indebted to Tertullian writing in Latin. And he writes a lot. Some of his most important things are he writes something called the Prescription Against Heretics. This is why all the heretics are wrong. And then Five Books Against Marcion, that guy we talked about a couple weeks ago with How the Christian Bible Formed. He writes a bunch of other things as well. So we want to look at a selection from Tertullian. So the thing under the Greek for philosophy there. So from Tertullian's Prescription Against Heretics 7:9, he writes, "What indeed has Athens to do with Jerusalem? What concord is there between the academy and the church? What between heretics and Christians? Our instruction comes from the porch of Solomon, who had himself taught that the Lord should be sought in simplicity of heart. Away with all attempts to produce a modeled Christianity of Stoic, Platonic, and dialectic composition. We want no curious disputation after possessing Christ Jesus, no inquisition after enjoying the gospel. With our faith, we desire no further belief. For this is our primary faith, that there is nothing which we ought to believe besides." So, this first line is famous. What has Athens to do with Jerusalem? That is, what does philosophy have to do with Christianity? You don't need philosophy to get to Christianity. Now, for Tertullian, human reason has become corrupt. Okay? Humans fell, and so even though Adam and Eve maybe had rational minds, the fall and the history of the world since the fall shows that humans don't actually possess reasonable reason anymore. We can't trust our minds. And so philosophy can't lead to Christianity. Christianity is the truth. Your mind is fallen. You can't connect the two. Furthermore, philosophy is oftentimes just asking questions, and asking questions endlessly. You never get to an answer in philosophy. You can only get to probabilities. So not only is your mind corrupt, but it misleads you into thinking that it's not. And so you use your mind, and you ask these endless questions, and you think you're getting closer to the truth, but you're actually not. So not only is philosophy not necessary, but it's lying to you constantly, too. You can't get to God by starting with questions for Tertullian. And the kicker for Tertullian is the fact that Jesus quotes the prophets, Jesus quotes Moses. We don't ever see Jesus quoting a philosopher. Like, if philosophers were so great, why didn't Jesus quote them? And kind of one of Tertullian's final arguments is sometimes faith doesn't make sense. Okay? That doesn't mean that faith is nonsensical. It just means that if you want to do theology, if you want to figure out who God is and how he wants you to live in the world, you should do theology. You should use the tools that theology gives you. You shouldn't use philosophy. Philosophy is the wrong set of tools to figure out who God is. Philosophy maybe can wrestle with these other abstract questions, but if you want to seek God, you need to use the right tools, and the right tools come through theology and not philosophy. And so Tertullian will appeal to Bible verses to support this too. So, Kyle, can you turn to Colossians 2:8? And Aldana, can you turn to 1 Corinthians 2:13? Colossians 2:8. Yep, whenever you're ready.
See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, not according to Christ.
See here, Tertullian says. Paul even gets this. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy, which he then associates with empty deceit. What is philosophy but empty deceit, Tertullian says? This is human tradition. It's not according to Christ. It's empty and it's deceitful. You should not use philosophy. Aldana.
This is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught by the Spirit, explaining spiritual realities in Spirit-taught words.
All right, so here we go again. Human wisdom, right? What is philosophy but the love of wisdom? And it's human wisdom at that. We're Christians. We don't need to study this human wisdom. We need to know all about what the Spirit says.
What verse was that?
That's 1 Corinthians 2:13. So, Tertullian says, look, your Bible, the living faith of the church. You don't need philosophy. You have these other sources that you can use to live out your faith. So what do you think? Is Tertullian right? What, Marilyn?
I don't know. I think he's right.
You think he's right?
I think he's right.
Tell me why.
Well,
it's a pretty persuasive argument.
Yeah, because just this week I learned that Spirit is what we use to know God's nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I learned it by reading the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I used to philosophize a lot, and I didn't realize. Now I think that it was a diversion.
Uh-huh.
Something. And I didn't decide that just today.
Sure. So experientially, philosophy seems divergent to you, right?
Yeah, I think it's a diversion.
Okay. All right.
I mean, if you want to, no, whatever.
All right. All right. What do you think, Aldana? Tertullian, right?
She makes sense.
She makes sense. All right. Okay.
I think Tertullian has a lot of validity.
Oh, don't use that logical, philosophical word.
I'm not disagreeing with him. I just also see the other side in that ideas have consequences.
Hmm.
And the times were brought forth from this philosophy mindset of the Greeks. Greeks were a hugely influential culture that set up this time where Jesus did come. And he knew that was how the people thought.
Mm-hmm.
So the way he communicated was based in that too. So I don't think you can completely disregard it because of the foundation of it.
Okay.
So, I'm kind of with Rachel. I agree with Tertullian in part. It's very persuasive how he says, you don't need it to get to the gospel, which is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very compelling. The problem is, on top of what Rachel said, so knowing how to, knowing your audience and how they're thinking so you can combat those false arguments, yes, I think the church should do philosophy in a way, but not, engage in, philosophical practices necessarily. The Bible needs to be, paramount.
Uh-huh.
And you can't really that guy from Alexandria, Philo. Philo. You can't really integrate this stuff and make sense. You can, I guess, some of it maybe,
uh-huh,
sort of kind of, but Solomon says seek wisdom.
Yep.
Wisdom is you should go after wisdom, and the true wisdom is the truth that we find in the Bible.
Yep.
And we can use that to all truth is God's truth. And I think you can't find shadows of truth in philosophy.
It can be confusing.
It can be very confusing.
When you say it's the love of you, you can make it your God.
Yes. Yes.
So at least it already comes from God, doesn't it? It doesn't all use philosophers. So I think you just go down the rabbit trail.
And there is a lot of rabbit trails within philosophy. That is, I think, the thing. But at the same time, there's a lot of good in that. I mean, Paul goes to Athens.
English, but what is it?
Right.
Yeah, and that's where the spirit enters in.
Yeah. That's where the spirit enters in, and we have our straight measuring stick right here.
You know, this is the home.
Right.
Above others.
Right. Yeah, if you do that, probably going to be the
truth. All right. So keep Petrillion in the back of your mind. This is important.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But he's not the only perspective on whether Christians should engage philosophy during this period. So the other person we're going to talk about is this guy named Justin Martyr. Justin lives about 100 to 165. It's actually a little earlier than Tertullian. And he's born in Samaria. And Justin's life is filled with trying out various philosophical schools. He tries out Stoicism, he tries out Epicureanism, he tries out Cynicism, he tries out Platonism. He tries all of these various schools. And eventually he travels to Rome and he is converted to Christianity. And he converts to Christianity because of its beautiful simplicity. It's reasonable, and it's reasonable without being overly complex, Justin says. And Justin becomes a Christian teacher of philosophy. He actually continues to wear the palladium, which is the outfit that a professional philosopher would wear in Rome. And he's a teacher. He teaches philosophy to Christians. He's teaching philosophy to Christians when he's arrested. And he's arrested in Rome about the year 165, and he's martyred, hence his name, under the philosopher emperor Marcus Aurelius, about 165. But before Justin dies, he writes quite a few things. He writes a number of apologetic works. He writes an apology to the Romans, or possibly two apologies to the Romans. He writes an apology to this guy named Trypho the Jew. He's writing to Romans, he's writing to Jews, he also writes against Marcion. I mention this because Marcion's just a really big deal. Everybody writes against Marcion in the early church. So he's a writer. He's a writer and he's a philosopher. So I want us to look at the second quote on your handout here. This is from Justin's Dialogue with Trypho the Jew, section 2. And this is what Justin has to say about philosophy. For philosophy is, in fact, the greatest possession and most honorable before God, to whom it leads us and alone commends us. And these are truly holy men who have bestowed attention on philosophy. What philosophy is, however, and the reason why it has been sent down to men, have escaped the observation of most. For there would be neither Platonists, nor Stoics, nor Peripatetics, nor Theoretics, nor Pythagoreans, this knowledge being one. Let's focus on the first part of that. Philosophy is the greatest possession and most honorable against men. Seems like a slightly different perspective than what Tertullian brings to the table. No? So for Justin, philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom, and Christianity represents the truest and highest form of seeking that wisdom. All wisdom is God's wisdom, so if you're seeking wisdom, why not do it like this? For Justin, when God created the world, he did so through Jesus, not just in a causal way. That is, Jesus didn't just sit down with a hammer and nails and make the world. Rather, Jesus created the world in a formal way. That is, human beings are formed after the Son. We look like Jesus. That's what it means to be made in the image of God for Justin. And all humans have the divine spark of Jesus in them. And so human beings have this inborn reason. That means, contrary to what Tertullian says, even though humans are fallen, they are capable of thinking and acting, sometimes even rightly. And this is because everybody participates in Jesus, even if you're not a Christian. And so if you look around the world, you can find truth everywhere. You can find people who have at least partial knowledge of the truth. So if you look at the Hindus or you look at the Buddhists, yeah, there are things that are wrong about their worldview, but there are also things that are right about their worldview. They have a partial grasp of the truth, and that's because they have some part of the truth, capital T, Jesus, within them. And so the world has been made after the pattern of Jesus, and because of this, philosophy is how we can engage everyone else. Philosophy appeals to that truth, to that reasonableness within every person. And so even though Debbie and I believe different things, hypothetically, we can use philosophy as the language to see what common ground we have and to ultimately point people to the truth that God created the world and that his son is the truth that we should all be seeking. And so Justin also has Bible verses he appeals to. Marilyn, can you turn to Proverbs 1:7? Debbie, can you do 1 Peter 3:15? And Rachel, can you do John 1? Not the whole thing, just 1 through 5. Whenever you're ready, Marilyn.
Okay, Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discernment.
See here, people like Tertullian, only a fool despises wisdom. You should seek after wisdom. And one of the ways that we find wisdom in this world is by doing philosophy, by learning from the God-given gifts that we have all been given. God gave everybody minds. God gave everybody the capacity to think. Why would we not learn from what other people, presumably those who are smarter than us, have learned as well? That would make you a fool if you didn't do that. Debbie, you have 1 Peter?
Yeah. What?
3:15.
But.
Oh, can you read all right? I don't mean to make you. Sorry.
Yeah, I can see.
Okay, that's fine. I have it here. First Peter 3:15, especially the second part of the verse says, always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting of the hope within you. Always be prepared to defend your faith. If you're going to defend your faith in the world of the first, second, and third century, you have to be able to defend your faith against philosophy. There are philosophers who write against Christianity. There's a really important guy. His name is Celsus. He writes about how Christianity is unreasonable. If you're going to respond to Celsus, you need to have some basic grasp of philosophy. You need to be able to defend your faith. The world demands that at least some of you know enough about philosophy to make a defense. And Rachel, John 1:1-5.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it.
All right. So this is part of the Johannine prologue, we call it. It's the beginning of John. And John gives us this beautiful theological exposition on who Jesus is. And this is the heart of Justin's theology. Because you can't understand what John is saying without understanding philosophy, Greco-Roman philosophy, especially Platonism. So, everybody turn to John 1. We're going to look at this through the light of Justin Martyr here. because this is where Justin's theology, it's sometimes called Logos theology, based on this word here. Logos is the word that every time you see the word word in the beginning of John, that's the word right there. Logos. It means word. It means reason. Right? This is who John identifies Jesus with. So, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So this is a very clear statement of Jesus' divinity here. He was in the beginning with God, and this is key. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. This is the heart of Justin's theology. This is the reasonableness of the world, the reason, the intellect, the ability to speak, that all is fundamentally present within Jesus. And this is where he finds this. Everything was made through him. And if everything was made through reason, through logos, how can you say that people aren't reasonable? At least deep down within them. Verse 4, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. All right, so here we go. Here's the divine spark. Everybody, no matter how sinful, no matter what religious system they belong to, somewhere in them there is truth, there is light, and that light belongs to Jesus. Verse 5, this light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And so, wherever you look in the world, you can find Jesus. Do you find the fullness of Jesus wherever you look in the world? No. You do not. You cannot. Because we are sinful and we are fallen. But fundamentally for Justin, even people who do not adhere to Christianity can be reasonable. And you can talk to them. And you can find within their system of beliefs something that is good to latch onto and to use that as a way to point them to the fullness of truth in Jesus. So look at this third excerpt we have. This is from Justin's first apology. This is how he worked this out. We have been taught that Christ is the firstborn of God, and we have declared above that he is the Word of whom every race of men were partakers. So he's just talking about this prologue to John. And those who have lived reasonably are Christians, even though they have been thought atheists. So he's going to tell us here who some of these people are who have lived in accordance with Jesus, who have lived in accordance with reason, even if they were before Jesus, right? So, as among the Greeks, Socrates and Heraclitus, and men like them, so Socrates is a Christian for Justin. And among the barbarians, that is everyone else who isn't Greek, Abraham and Ananias and Azarias and Mishael and Elias, that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and many others whose actions and names we now decline to recount, because we know it will be tedious. So that even they who lived before Christ and lived without reason were wicked and hostile to Christ and slew those who were reasonable. So, these people, Justin says, who have lived like Christ have been persecuted in the same way that Christians are now being persecuted. That's his argument. All right? So, for Justin, evil always persecutes truth. And so if you look back in history and you see wicked people persecuting good people, you should look at those good people and try to figure out if there was something fundamentally Christian about them. So if you know anything about Socrates, there's a trial that Socrates undergoes because he is corrupting the youth. And so Justin looks at this and goes, no, he wasn't corrupting the youth. He was actually preaching the Logos. He was teaching people to live in accordance with the true God. That's why he was persecuted. All right, and then we get to this statement about who Jesus is. But who, through the power of the Word, according to the will of God the Father and Lord of all, he was born of a virgin as a man and was named Jesus, who was crucified and died and rose again and ascended to heaven. An intelligent man will be able to comprehend from what has been already largely said. All right, so that is, when Jesus comes, what he does is reasonable. You expect the incarnate Word, the incarnate Logos, to act and live in a certain way. And so if Socrates had been able to read the Gospel of Mark, he would have said, oh yeah, this is the guy we've been waiting for, because he does things and he acts the way you would expect divine reason to act if he comes into the world. So, for Justin, philosophy is good, or at least it can be good. Not all philosophy is good, but philosophy that reflects the truth, that reflects the divine word that is within every person, is good philosophy, and it can be useful. And in fact, it's important for Christians to seek wisdom and to be able to make a defense of their faith, as Justin does with his life. All right, so what do you make of Justin's theology? It's a little different than Tertullian.
Yeah.
And I know that's a lot. What do you think, Rachel?
Well, I don't think just because Socrates might have had truth would make him a Christian. Christ.
So if Socrates lives before Jesus, can you have Jesus if you live before Jesus? What about Abraham? Was Abraham in heaven?
Abraham saw his day.
Abraham did see his day. Yes, this is true. Think of Paul.
There was like an acknowledgement of Yahweh for Abraham. And I don't know that Socrates
seems to have believed in one all-powerful God.
Yeah. I don't know enough about that.
Whether he called him, he didn't call him Yahweh, but.
I think Socrates is a bad example.
You think Socrates is a bad example?
Yeah.
Who would be a better example?
Epicurus.
All right. That's okay.
Just like what Socrates says, some people have made arguments that he had a revelation of some sort.
Right. Okay. So maybe there's too much special revelation at work.
Maybe.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, I actually really agree with Justin Martin on most issues, on most things. But, I don't know. I don't know. That's a little bit of a stretch to say. I mean, it's an interesting thought to say, like, well, these people were persecuted and they were at least kind of on the right track, so therefore they must have been a Christian.
Right. That seems a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, because you can't say that every person that was persecuted or it was reasonable.
Right.
You know, and I don't think that's necessarily what he's saying, but it's an interesting consideration. I just don't think it always goes
well. Are you ladies think? What about Justin? That's okay.
I think I would be very confused.
Okay. Tell me more.
It's about God and only about seeking Him.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that wisdom was just the thing of God.
Right.
I didn't know you could seek wisdom and maybe better things about getting wrong information or.
So, what Justin would say is if you find true wisdom in any of these other things, it is God.
Yeah.
You are finding God's wisdom. Even if you find it through these other things. All truth is God's truth.
If you know that it is true, I guess.
Okay, so can you explain to me? No. Let's try it this way. Why don't the sun's ultraviolet rays kill you when you walk outside?
The sky is already set in motion by its own
speed. Okay, but we can't, like. We can, I don't think any of us can explain that.
No.
Right?
There's a lot of things you can't explain. With these.
Right. So
these are human beings, right?
Usually.
Usually. I said I never studied philosophy, so there's a lot of things here I don't understand.
Sure.
So.
That's fine.
Answer.
Yeah.
With wisdom, I don't think I can.
I just want us to be wary of saying, oh, we don't, if we don't understand something, it can't be God's truth, right? Or it can't be useful. Because I have only a cursory understanding of how the atmosphere reflects harmful solar radiation, right? there are people who can tell you all sorts of things about that. That doesn't make it any less true that that happens, right? Or any less good. Or any less part of how God created the world. Right? All of those things are true, even if we can't explain it. So I would say something like, that's truth. Right? And that truth is God's truth. So even though I can explain that as an atmospheric scientist, that doesn't mean... So there is something in atmospheric science that is true and good, and it points to God.
Right. You can stumble upon... you can find that truth, and having never studied the Bible, you can still know that truth.
Right.
Now, obviously that's a lot less useful than knowing the Bible.
Right.
But there's still, just within that body of work, some sort of useful, helpful, true knowledge.
It doesn't necessarily mean God, because you believe in science, and maybe the Big Bang Theory or something, you know.
Sure, but does it point people toward God? Or can it point people toward God?
Yes, it can.
In my experience, it very often does point people towards God.
The Big Bang Theory just says something bang, it doesn't say
who bang.
Who or what?
Intelligent desires.
Right.
Right. You know. Exactly.
So, yeah. Another thing we could wrestle with is if you get to, and we call this the God of philosophy, if you take all of the arguments from philosophy for the existence of God, for example, Aristotle's unmoved mover, that is, there has to be a first cause that sets all the other causes in motion. Right? Is that God? Well, yes and no, right?
Right.
That's an all-powerful eternal being. It's an all-powerful primordial being who creates the universe as we know it. Is that Yahweh?
It never says that.
You have to connect the dots there, right? Mm-hmm. So what Justin is saying is, part of what Justin is saying is, if you get back to the unmoved mover, if you get back to Aristotle's all-powerful first cause, you're actually worshiping God, even if you don't know his name is Jesus. So we're out of time, so we can't work through all of that, but that's a consideration at work here as well.
Scientists have studied all the cosmos. Why does that never point to the Creator?
Okay, so it points lots of scientists to the Creator. Cosmologists and physicists especially, there has to be a designer behind all this. That's a fairly common thing to say. Yeah. We will have a whole class on how the history of science and the history of Christianity run into each other, and we may actually have a class on that in a Sunday school class on that in the future, because lots of people are very interested in how do faith and science work together, right? But not all science is atheistic,
right? And there's also a lot of really good scientists who aren't very good philosophers,
right? Yes, yes,
who can
terrible
analyze,
philosophers
who can analyze data but cannot think.
Don't put that into a worldview framework very well.
Yes.
They don't organize their data very well. We're like, oh yeah, this means that. Nah, no, it doesn't mean that.
Right.
Because they're good zoologists, but they're bad philosophers.
Right. So you have that at places.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked about Justin and Tertullian today. Two perspectives. Should Christians engage philosophy? Most of the church says yes. At least in some sense, we're going historically. Most people follow Justin a little more than they follow Tertullian. You're going to use the philosophy, and you're going to use the ways of thinking and the ways of trying to figure out what wisdom is and how it applies to your life. And we're going to read that through Jesus. We're going to read that through the scriptures. But we are going to use Plato and Aristotle to help us understand our Christianity.
Did you say whether or not you use the word philosophy, you're using philosophy?
Yeah, I would say that, yes.
I think you're asking the same questions, and I think the word philosophy has a lot of misconception with it.
Yes.
And I think, we're designed to ask those questions.
Yes.
And so I think we're using philosophy, whether or not we call it that.
Yeah. Whether you call it philosophy or not, everyone answers traditional philosophical questions. How do I know what's real? How do I know that I know? things like this. We all operate that way. So whether you call it philosophy or not, you're absolutely right. And for me, when I run into someone like Justin Martyr, I see someone who allows me to redeem sometimes even the worst philosophies by looking for Jesus in them. And by saying, you know what? If people are going to use these terms and have these conversations, I need to be there with Christ in their midst. And being able to say, all right, we've gotten to an unmoved mover. Cool, what next? I said, no, wait, there's more. I have a name for your unmoved mover, and here he is.
Thank you for listening to the Pursuing Veritas podcast. We hope that you enjoyed what you heard today and that you will consider subscribing either via pursuingveritas.com or iTunes.